Your recordings have started.
Thanks, Marie. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the IMGO Cure Device Protection PDP Working Group meeting on the 4th of August at 1600 UTC. On the call today, we do have George Kiriko, Tedder Renforth, Jay Chapman, Philip Corwin, Paul Tattersfield, Mason Cole. We have no apologies. From staff, we have David Tate, Emily Barabas, Barry Cobb, Mary Wong, and myself, Michelle D. Smiter. I would like to remind you all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you. I would like to turn the meeting over to Philip Corwin.
Well, welcome, everyone, to today's call of the IGO Curative Rights Process Working Group. I know George Kirikos commented in the chat room that we have an equal number of staff and actual members of the working group on the call today. I'm not that surprised that attendance by members is low in August, and that's going to tie to final agenda item, which is talking about taking the rest of the month off, but doing a lot of work by email with the full working group, including the members who aren't able to make it to the calls, and then reconvening in the first week of September. But we're going to continue discussion of policy options. So if staff could put the operative document on the screen. Okay. Okay, so, can we unlock that so I can scroll? I think it is now. So let's see, this is a three-page document, so, and this was updated 2 days ago. Okay, so let's go through it. The background, I think we all know the background to where we are and how we got here. Let's go through policy options, see if there's any remaining discussion on any of them. Item A, no change to the mutual jurisdiction clause and current procedures, but add ability for IGO to assign its substantive legal, that is, trademark rights to another party, or assign its right to sue, or appoint an agent, or have a licensee. And I think on last week's call, my recollection is that we with George's help and some other folks, we identified the license option and found that that has been accepted in prior UDRP and it might also be the most acceptable one on appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction rather than an assignment or use of an agent. So so I think this is about providing IGOs which are reluctant to exercise their rights in any process that might lead them to a courtroom down the road to give them some insulation by acting through a third party. And I think we have general consensus that we should make that available. Any discussion on that point? Petter and then George. Go ahead, Petter.
Thanks, Petter, input here. I was typing it, but can just state it shortly. What is needed is at least some kind of document showing that the complainant has rights from the holder. So, as I said, there are clear documentations as license agreements, but there are also other kind of cooperation agreement or when you can show that you're a subsidiary in a group representing the main company as a trademark holder or vice versa. So there's some kind of on contractual document. But as you said, if we can see a pure traditional license agreement, that's of course the best one, the most clear documentation. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Petter, and let me just comment before we go to George that I think on all of these things we're considering, we're going to have to look at when we get down to the final report and recommendations, whether these options that were agreed upon through consensus can be accomplished simply by providing guidance to the UDRP providers or whether we have to amend the actual language of the policy. We haven't really looked at the language yet, but I just wanted to note that to accomplish many of these things, guidance may be sufficient. On some of them, we may actually have to go in and suggest a very surgical, limited amendment of the policy to make sure that these things can be accomplished. Go ahead, George.
George Kirkus here. Yes, I was just about to say what Phil just said, that the current document says, but add the ability for IGO, blah, 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 to assign its rights. As Phil said, we don't necessarily need to add the ability if the ability is already present. We just might need to highlight that that ability already exists and, you know, provide guidance in a supplementary document and not change the policy at all.
Okay. Next item is item B, amend the current procedures by adding an arbitral appeal mechanism for IGO domain disputes. And there was a note we need to discuss whether the UNCTAD trial rules were appropriate for this purpose. I would add, personally, speaking personally, also I have to decide whether UNCTAD trial, because it's part of the UN family, is the proper venue for, if we went with this option, to hear disputes brought by UN-affiliated agencies, or whether that creates a perception of some bias for the registrant who would be involved. Let me ask staff, have we, Mary, I think you might have provided the rules to us. Am I correct on that, if I could call on you?
Hi, Phil. Hi, everyone. This is Mary from staff. Yes, I sent around a note to the working group list after the call last week that enclosed a link to the UNCITRAL rules and several notes that the staff made in our quick review of the rules. I should say, of course, that none of the staff are experts on international arbitration or using the UNCITRAL rules, but we believe that those notes and observations in that email are of interest to the working group, in particular the fact that those rules are procedural only and they don't bind the parties, even if they agree to use the UNCITRAL rules, to a particular venue or a particular institution. So in that respect, they're different from some of the rules that you may be familiar with. I believe the ICC and others have a venue-based arbitration. So I won't repeat what else is in that email, but those were just some initial observations that we thought were interesting to help the working group deliberate whether indeed the UNCITRAL rules as procedural rules would be helpful. And we note that this is also one of the options that was brought up by Professor Swain in his memo in terms of looking at this particular option. Thanks, Phil.
Right. So, Mary, just to clarify, are you saying that the UNCITRAL rules being merely procedural, that UNCITRAL wouldn't necessarily be the deciding forum for an arbitration?
So I would defer to experts on this point, but from our reading of the UNCITRAL rules, that seems to be the case, yes.
Okay. And all right, I think we're going to have to look into that and maybe ask staff to take a look at when disputes are brought under the UNCITRAL rules, what forum are they brought in? So you're basically saying the parties adopt the UNCITRAL procedural rules, but the actual arbitration takes place outside of our UNCITRAL in a different arbitration forum that's mutually agreed to by the parties.
Phil, if I may, this is Mary again. Like I said, that is our reading, and the rules themselves do seem to contemplate that you may not need to have a full oral physical hearing. That said, as you noted, we don't have any particular experience, nor have we done any research on how a proceeding under the UNCITRAL rules is actually done.
Yeah, let me, on that point, and again, speaking personally, the fact that they say you don't need a full detailed hearing, I'm not sure that's satisfactory for our purposes, where the losing party in a UDRP, whether it's the registrant or the IGO, this is a substitute for a court of mutual jurisdiction. So they're giving up or choosing an alternative to a judicial procedure with all its discovery and safeguards and all of that. And I think we have to be looking at something that's fairly robust if we're going to look at replacing access to court. And, George, I see your hand up. Is that for this issue? Okay. George's hand is withdrawn. All right. So unless there's further comment on B, let's go to C. No change in mutual jurisdiction clause in current procedures, but add an ability only for particular IGOs to op-orbital appeal, most likely the UN and specialized agencies based on international conventions applicable to the UN, and absolute immunity in at least some jurisdiction. My comment personal on that is that given what Professor Swain told us about, basically you won't know what the jurisdiction rule is for a particular agency until a judge in a particular jurisdiction decides whether or not it can be brought into a courtroom there. I'm just wondering if we have the ability to pre-identify them or whether we make this an option when an IGO is brought into court or goes into court. As we described last week, there's two situations. One, the registrant appeals, and the IGO being brought into that courtroom says, we shouldn't be here, we have absolute immunity, and the court agrees, and then you would want an alternative process so the registrant has somewhere else to appeal the decision. The other would be the more problematic, where the IGO is dissatisfied with the UDRP result, and it would be put in the strange position of going into a court to ask the court to decide that it can't be part of a process in that court. So we have to think more about that, in my personal opinion. Comments on C? Okay, next option is rewrite the mutual jurisdiction clause. And this would basically be, it would cover the first situation I just described where the IGO is brought into court involuntarily by an appealing registrant and asserts its immunity and the court agrees. Then we're providing the registrant with an alternative forum, some type of forum, for their appeal. I know George has suggested that if the IGO successfully insists on, gets a ruling in favor of its having immunity, that the original UDRP decision should become null and void. I'm personally not sure I'd go for that because that would leave us with situations in which no one can decide, in which a UDRP panel or panelists has found infringement to be occurring, and the end result is that it's allowed to continue. If that decision is correct, of course, the registrant would be contesting it, but I'm kind of troubled by the fact that there'd be no final resolution of the dispute and the status quo ante would be returned to. Other comments on D? Oh, George said that was Paul Keating's suggestion, not mine. Sorry, George, for misidentifying that, and apologies to Paul, who's not on today's call, for appropriating his idea to you. And a note from Mary in the chat room on option C, staff notes that the GAC did not make a distinction between the UN and other IGOs. Okay. Well, they didn't make a distinction, but we can if we so decide to do so. Okay, option E, the last option on this list, no change to mutual jurisdiction clause in current procedures, but clarify that standing to file for IGOs must be that the requisite notification of WIPO has been made pursuant to the Article 6 tier of the Paris Convention. We would nevertheless discuss the separate issue of what substantive legal rights would form the legal grounds for the complaint. Yeah, we do need to discuss that. I would personal comment again. I think this is we've already agreed, of course, that an IGO which has registered trademark rights has no problem bringing a UDRP. So this would be, I think it's clarify that standing to file for IGOs, this would be an additional ground for standing in addition to its trademark rights. I think we should just clarify that in the in this. And I think the substantive legal right, we need to flesh that out, but obviously Article 6-tier registration provides IGOs with protections in the trademark regimes of the signatory nations to Article 6-tier as well as WTO members. So those are the rights. We're saying that those rights, because they're interwoven with the trademark system, are sufficient to give standing to bring a UDRP. And again, we're going to need to look at whether that can be accomplished by guidance to the dispute resolution providers for the UDRP, or whether we need to actually go in and do a surgical amendment of the standing provision of the UDRP. Comments on item E? All right, seeing none. Discussion. Okay, introducing an arbitral appeal mechanism. Would it be an effective and fair alternative to the ability to file in a national court? You know, open that for discussion. We have to make sure that if we go that route, that it does provide sufficiently robust procedural and substantive rights to be the a rough equivalent of a court proceeding, and that it's an objective forum. Those are my comments on that. Let me go through all this under discussion, then we'll open it for discussion by the working group. Consideration, substantial number of UDRP decisions are overturned by subsequent adjudication. So we have to leave the respondent with additional avenues of redress. And, I personally absolutely agree with that, and that's particularly the case where the registrant appeals to a court and the IGO would successfully assert its immunity from that court proceeding. In that case, access to arbitration would be to the benefit of the registrant. So I think we need to keep in mind that we have situations where an arbitration forum availability would benefit the registrant who's lost a UDRP and believes it was wrongly decided. Next point, the working group may need to consider if changing immunity rules for IGOs would have ramifications elsewhere. We'll take a look at that. I'm not sure it would, but we'll consider that as we prepare the final report. Pool of cases likely to be very small. Agreed on that. You know, we've I think that's the reason we've already had a consensus not to create an entirely new CRP. What we're talking about is the possibility of arbitration at the end of a UDRP or URS, not a procedure that's entirely separate from the beginning. And valuable domain names, some are very valuable. Okay, unless we get rid of the UDRP, that's a possibility I don't think we've ever discussed, and I think one that the ICANN community would never support. Why would a registrant give up rights to seek protection in a national court? Good question, but as I just pointed out, there may be situations where a registrant appeals to a court of mutual jurisdiction and because it's lost the UDRP and the IGO successfully asserts immunity, then the availability of an arbitration forum would give the registrant at least some possibility of a reversal of the decision. Without that, there'd be no effective appeal. Mr. Keating's suggestion was in that case vitiate the UDRP decision, but that could have the undesirable effect of permitting infringement to go on with no effective remedy, which we probably wouldn't want to see happen either. So those are my personal thoughts on these points. Let's open it up for group discussion on everything under the discussion before we get into the additional suggestions. And meanwhile, I'm looking at the chat room. Yeah, George, I would just say, personal comment, I'm not sure we're talking about compelling a registrant to give up legal. I think we're considering what happens where an IGO can successfully assert immunity in the applicable courts. Okay. No further comment on George's comments in the chat room. And Mary noted that these are all these considerations are summaries of comments made by members of this working group in prior meetings. Mary, we are aware they're not staff observations, just excellent staff summaries of working group observations. Mr. Kirikos, please proceed verbally.
George Kirikos here. That part about unless we get rid of the UDRP, it kind of misstated what I intended to say. What I meant by that last part is, let's imagine that the UDRP didn't exist. You know, ICANN didn't need to create the UDRP. The UDRP is like an entirely optional complement to the legal system. If we imagine a world without the UDRP, what would happen? The IGO would, by necessity, have to go to court and thereby waive immunity. And so all I kind of meant by that is, why would a registrant, voluntarily give up their right to access the courts when an IGO would have to, you know, give up their immunity and go to those courts for redress? Like, there's
right.
No way that an IGO could say, you know, I have a dispute with you, and I'm going to force you to come to, you know, where I want you to go to handle that dispute. You know, they'd be laughed at by, you know, whoever they had the dispute with. And that was the kind of the point I was trying to make with the examples where the IGOs send the cease and desist letters. Like, they send these cease and desist letters with a threat of something, and that threat of something usually is legal action. And so that's how the real world operates, and there's no reason why the domain name world should be any different. Like, we shouldn't be creating a policy that replaces the legal system, just acts as a convenient alternative that complements the legal system for some kinds of disputes, not all disputes. And that procedure is complementary. It doesn't replace it because it allows appeals to that, you know, full legal system. Otherwise, there'd be a divergence between the two systems. If that separate process existed without the ability to appeal to the real courts, then you could see how it would be very dangerous, because a set of parallel laws that diverge, well, they'd no longer be parallel. You'd have a separate court with its own jurisprudence without the ability to go back to the real courts to see how things should be decided. And so I guess the fear is that you would get results in the arbitration that don't reflect what happens in the real courts, and that's, you know, what's the ultimate danger.
Okay. Thank you for those observations, George. Petter, please go ahead.
Thanks. I'm also want to talk about the arbitration. I understand, as we have heard from the IGOs, that they may accept that there are no specific changes in the policies as such if there is a way to take the next step to an arbitration rather than having to go to a specific national court. However, I've seen a lot of these kind of dispute resolution processes when it comes to other kind of IP disputes. And as I said, George, it's a difficult way to solve it rather than if you take it to the traditional court action. But I think the main problem here is if we decide that we should not change the policy but rather come up with some recommendations, then it will be, I can't see how we can introduce an arbitral appeal mechanism without changing the policy as such. And also, as we have seen, there are there have been a lot of traditional national court cases, and some states that they can deal with IG-related disputes, and other states that they can't. So I think that step is actually something that we have to leave to the market and to the each national court. And I prefer if we can stick to some kind of just clarification or recommendation rather than making any additional policy amendments or even creating some kind of next step, because I don't think we can do that without also changing the dispute resolution policies as such. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Petter. And speaking personally, I agree. If we were going to create any an avenue by which an IGO could get to an arbitration forum by any means, we'd have to amend the UDRP to do that. On the other things we're talking about in terms of using a licensee or an agent or and relying on Article 6 tier registration for standing grounds and for bringing in action, we need to look at the policy, but that may be achievable simply by guidance to the providers. But certainly the arbitration route would require this. And again, speaking personally, yeah, George, I took all your points. I would point out UDRP was created for all trademark holders, not just IGO, so they'd have a less expensive way of resolving domain disputes, a faster and less expensive way than relying on the court system. And so far as, you know, any access to immunity, to an arbitration forum, would be based on immunity. And I think the one clear thing from Professor Swain's memo is that there's no blanket rule. It's going to be decided differently for different types of IGOs in different national courts. Some will find immunity, some will find no immunity. So it's not something we can create a blanket rule for. So let's see, no further hands up. You know, George, I'm going to ask you a question about your last comment in the chat room. How would we know what's a very valuable domain? I mean, would it be based on what the current registrant paid for it? But what if the registrant, you know, was the original registrant and has just kept the paying the registration fees year after year? The registrant might assert it has a 4, 5, 6-figure value. But how would we test that? And would that, I think introducing that would certainly require amendment of the UDRP.
George, to
introduce domain valuation for what would happen in or after a UDRP.
George Greigless here. I don't think the UDRP panelists are typically very expert at valuing the domain names, but just thinking rationally, a UDRP costs, you know, $1,000 to $2,000 to file, maybe $5,000 for, you know, the legal costs involved. So it's really meant for early, you know, designed for disputes over relatively small things, whereas a court action might cost somebody $50,000 or $100,000. So it would make very little economic sense for somebody to appeal to the courts over, you know, a $1,000 domain name when it would cost them $50,000 or more to fight for it. Like, just thinking rationally. we know that, you know, every twoletter.com, for example, has a wholesale value of at least $800,000 these days. Threeletter.coms, you know, anywhere from 50,000 plus, you know, some have hit seven figures. Some of it actually hit eight figures, sex.com, but that was a word as well as an acronym. Or false.
Well, yeah, but George, are you suggesting we create a rule that IGOs have to waive immunity if they file UDRPs against two or three letter .coms, or are you asserting that we should create a provision in the UDRP where a registrant can assert, can provide some proof of alleged valuation and say if this is going to proceed, the IGO has to waive? I'm just trying to figure out the mechanics of this, and it would certainly require some extensive amendment of the UDRP policy to introduce the concept of considering valuation and what effect it should have on the procedure.
George Griglis here again. Sorry, perhaps the point I was trying to make I didn't make very clearly. My point was that IGOs should continue to waive their immunity for all the cases, just as they would have to do under the existing UDRP. My point was that their only concern really is that the appeal is only going to happen for high-value domain names. And so when, you know, as a practicality, most of the low-value domains, look, let's say somebody registers UNESCO t-shirts.org or something like that, that's a relatively low-value domain name. If they won the UDRP, the odds of the registrant appealing that are very low, given that it makes almost no economic sense for them to do so. However, you know, if they went after a different domain,
okay,
say uf.com, that domain name is very valuable, so the registrant is undoubtedly going to appeal if they lose, and that actually maintains the status quo that would exist if the UDRP itself didn't exist. You know, it would inevitably end up in court, and so that waiver of immunity didn't really change things because it would go to court anyways. So, and then the UDRP was designed in that way. It says, here's a procedure, you know, we recognize the courts exist. If people agree that the UDRP is the final decision, they both, you know, don't
agree. All right. So you weren't suggesting that we create a separate valuation rule. You were suggesting that appeals by registrants will only likely occur when it's a valuable domain name.
Correct. And so, and that's when you want the legal courts to exist, to exercise, you know, their jurisdiction when it's, you know, an important dispute. And the UDRP kind of wasn't really designed for that. It was, you know, a streamlined procedure with no discovery, you know, not all the safeguards that exist in a real court.
Right. Okay. All right. Mary, I see your hand up.
Yes, thanks, Phil. Not so much to respond to George, but more broadly on the general question of a kind of arbitral appeal mechanism that could be an alternative for going to court. We just wanted to note for the record again that the staff had prepared a note that we referred to in our last email on the UNSA trial rules about how that kind of appeal mechanism might function, and that was a reference to a paper that was done by the WIPO secretary some time ago in relation to country names and state immunity, so not specific to IGOs, but they had set out some general principles that would be, in our view, relevant if this group is considering that as well. For example, that it should be a de novo appeal, and so the case should be basically something that can be argued anew, and that the burden of doing an arbitration should not be more burdensome than if it were in a national court, and of course that the arbitrators, one or more, would need to be neutral and not connected with the original decision. But on top of that, we also thought what was interesting was that from that paper, the implication was that the mutual jurisdiction clause could stay as it is, but that in initiating a complaint, the IGO, or in that case the state, would have to agree to the arbitral appeal mechanism, but whether or not that mechanism is triggered at the appeal stage is for the losing respondent or whichever the losing party is to decide. So in some ways that preserves the ability to go to a national court while also adding the express alternative of an arbitral appeal mechanism. This is not the staff view as to whether this is the way to go or whether it's better or worse, but because
right.
it's somewhat of a tweak on options A to E, we thought it might be timely to note this for the group. Thanks, Phil.
Yeah, thank you, Mary. Have we seen that WIPO paper? Has it been distributed in the past to this working group?
I think it would be the dim and distant past, but we're happy to recirculate them.
Yeah, why don't we recirculate it? I think it's timely now. All right, let's get to additional suggestions here. We're 36 past the hour. Number one, consider a tweak to the procedures rather than replacing the right to appeal to a national court. If a winning IGO is brought to court by a losing respondent, allow for the result of the IGO's successfully winning a claim of immunity in that court to be a nullification of the UDRP decision. That was Paul Keating's suggesting. And again, personally, that one disturbs me somewhat because that would permit the situation where a low-value domain like UNESCO T-shirts dot something that was clearly infringing and selling T-shirts, the proceeds of which were not supporting UNESCO in any way, to continue its operations even after the registrant lost in the UDRP proceeding. I'm not that accepting of that possibility. Question A, would this preclude the IGO from then proceeding to file a claim against the respondent in court itself? I don't know that we have personal, these are all personal comments. I don't know that we have to decide it. I think the burden would be on the IGO to successfully assert that it was immune and then go back to the same court or a different court and said, and initiate a legal proceeding. I think the registrant and say, hey, wait a minute, judge. How can they both successfully assert immunity and then access the courts? I'm not sure we're the ones to decide that, but we can discuss that. Number B, may need to consider the legal implications of nullification or procedural rather than substantive grounds. I have nothing to further say on nullification. Item two, would it be better to create a policy guidance framework rather than change the underlying policy? I think it's, based on all the comments that are made, I think that it's the general consensus that I'm hearing in this group that when we come to our final recommendations, they should only result in very surgical revisions of the UDRP itself only if it's absolutely necessary to implement those recommendations, that if they can be implemented by guidance, that's the preferable way, that we should change the UDRP to the minimum extent and only where it's absolutely necessary to get the result that we want to see implemented. So I will stop there and see if we have any group discussion on these additional suggestions. And I'm seeing and hearing none. So, and I'm looking at the chat room. Nothing new on these issues. So, all right, well, it's 39 past the hour. That's all this. Oh, wait. There's one last one. I just scrolled down. There's one short paragraph on the top page. And I hear a barking dog reminding me that I had missed it. Noting that a guidance document would not be addressed enough to address the trademark rights substantive basis of the UDRP ERS, this may require actually amending. Yeah, I think we've taken note of that. And we've noted we're going to have to look at the actual language of the UDRP and the URS in regard to use of a licensee, agent, or other third party to bring the action and to use the Article 6-tier registration as a basis for standing and decide whether we need to surgically recommend amending the policy or whether that can be done through guidance. So I don't think there's any dispute that I'm not sure this is correct, this assertion that it wouldn't be enough, but I do agree that we need to look very carefully at those questions when we put our final recommendations to get there. All right. So unless there's last chance now for any substantive discussion on this paper, and then we're going to describe next steps, what we're going to do the remainder of the month in this working group, what we propose to do with your acquiescence. With the acquiescence of the working group, the co-chairs are proposing no further telephone meetings of this group for the remainder of August. Reasons for that is that I cannot be on the call next week. I'm going to be on vacation in a very remote area of Maine, and also I'm just unplugging for a week. And Petter's going to be unable to be on the call, following two calls in August. So we have just one co-chair, and we think we're at a critical stage where we want both co-chair involved. We also think there's work to be done that we can do, accomplish through email, and then kick off in September. And let me just look at the calendar. So we're proposing that not to have working group calls on the 11th, 18th, or 25th of August, the next 3 weeks, and to reconvene on Thursday, September 1. But to use the time in between to create, to work with staff to create an outline of what should be in a final report and recommendations from this group to list all the considerations, all the things we've taken into consideration, all the preliminary recommendations we're going to make, and get that outline completed so that when we come back together on September 1, we can actually get into the begin the drafting of that report. And Mary has just put out a draft anticipated timeline. So you can see the rest of the month, we straw poll the members, all the members, not just the ones on the calls. Lori, let me just get through this, and I'll take your I see your hand up. I want to note that, but I want to just go through this and then open it for a group discussion. Excuse me. First two meetings in September, discuss the outline and its elements and have staff begin filling it out. Second half of September, discuss our preliminary conclusions. Then staff would draft and circulate an initial draft report for consideration throughout the month of October, looking to publish that initial report in late October so that it's out there for the community to discuss when we meet in Hyderabad in early November. And then after Hyderabad, through the rest of November, begin discussion of community feedback and public comments. The public comment would close early December. We'll continue that discussion in the first 2 weeks of the public comments, the first 2 weeks of December. No meetings the second half of December. We'd get back to considering the public comments in first part of January and consider changes to a any changes to be made to a draft final report, and then with the aim, you see the rest of February, basically aiming to wrap up and submit a final report for GNSO Council consideration, if they approve it for board consideration, the end of February. So we're not projecting to be done this year, but we are projecting to get a draft initial report out by late October, and then to wrap everything up in February of next year and to be done with our work in February and hand it off for GNSO Council consideration. Lori, I see a comment by you in the chat room. I'm not comfortable ruling it out if we don't have any data. I'm in the dark. Which data are we talking about here?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Data on the operation of the UNCTAD Trail rules. I see that now.
This goes back to my question from last week when I raised it, because I understand your point about the optics. You don't want to, you want to avoid an appearance of impropriety. I get that. But on the other hand, I gave it more thought in between calls. And I'm still stuck on this point, and I just put a link in that I will look at. To just make sure we understand that, you know, are these rules weighted for or against agencies, or are they truly balanced? Are the decisions that are coming out under the rules balanced decisions? If they are balanced, if we're seeing sort of a 50-50 batting average on this, then I think it's realistic. If we see something like 90% in favor of UN agencies, then I would tend to agree we would want to eliminate that as even an option. That's all. I guess I'm sticking on this data point, if there is data.
Yeah, thank you for that, Lori. I think, you know, just off the top of my head, I see a couple of questions about the UNTA trial procedures. One, we have to determine whether UNTA trial is the forum, which creates what could be negative optics, or whether these are just procedural rules that are applied in a separate arbitration forum that's mutually agreed to by the parties. The second is whether Mary described them as pretty bare-bones rules, and I think that raises a question whether they really, you know, I think we all agree it's going to be a de novo consideration. It's not really an appeal. It's a new de novo procedure, but whether it gives the same procedural and substantive protections and rights that you would get in a court procedure. And I think, third, we have to look at the cost question. Professor Swain seemed to suggest that arbitration could be even more expensive than a judicial proceeding, and that raises some issues. So, yeah, I think there's the threshold question whether we're going to provide for the possibility of recourse to arbitration in any circumstances, and then there's the secondary question of if we are, where that would be and under what rules. And I'll stop there, and do we have further comment on that topic or on the proposal to suspend calls for the remainder of the month, create an outline for a final report and recommendations through email, and then reconvene on September 1 to discuss the outline? Any comment on that? Any objections? I see George a check mark, so I guess that's people agreeing with the proposal. So, all right. Well, seeing lots of agrees and no X's, and hearing no objections from, so we've now got agreement from four of the five folks here. But now I see Jay Chapman and David Marr having their hands up. Jay and then David, go ahead. Oh, I think that was just agreeing, because I see the hands down now. All right, so seeing and sensing agreement and hearing no objections, we're going to go ahead and cancel any working group calls for the remainder of August. That doesn't mean we won't be working. We will be working with staff to create and approve an outline for everything that should be addressed in the draft final report and recommendations to be issued by this working group later this fall, and we will reconvene by phone on September 1st to discuss that draft outline and then move forward with actually making final decisions and working with staff to draft the actual text of that initial draft report. So that's the plan going forward. And we will, I'm going to ask staff to memorialize that in a short email that can be circulated to the entire working group so that the folks who were not on this call, though I see our attendance has increased since the beginning of the call, but I think we still have some members who weren't on the call. So everybody's aware and all the observers are aware of exactly how we plan to proceed. Okay, staff? Mary says two will do in the chat room. So it's 10 before the hour. Unless someone has anything else they want to raise verbally, I'm going to give you those 10 minutes back, and we'll speak by phone again on September 1. So I see no hands up, so we're going to adjourn the call now. Everybody, if you're taking off for August, have a good and safe vacation. And please participate in the work we'll be doing by email through the remainder of August. Thank you. Bye now.
Thank you. Today's meeting has been adjourned.